This episode is part of the 2017 AADL Summer Game, and has clues embedded in it that can be used to win points and glory in the Summer Game itself. Just listen for the special sound effect at certain points in this episode, and go to play.aadl.org and follow the instructions on how to use this knowledge for personal gain. You certainly don't have to play the game in order to enjoy this episode. One final note, Ann Arbor Stories will be at Literati Bookstore on Monday, July 12th at 7 p.m., presenting two all-new Ann Arbor Stories, live with music, old photos, and this made-for-shortwave radio voice. For more details, check out the events page at literatibookstore.com or twitter.com/AnnArborStories. We'd love to see you. This is Ann Arbor Stories. I'm Rich Reddy. In 1903, Orville Wright achieved first flight. In 1927, Charles Lindbergh landed the Spirit of St. Louis on an airfield in Paris, becoming the first person to complete a solo, non-stop flight across the Atlantic. The following year, as part of a three-person crew, Amelia Earhart became the first female aviator to cross the Atlantic, earning the love of a nation. Riding in a convertible next to her fellow aviators, rolling slowly down Broadway Avenue and the Canyon of Heroes in Manhattan, while ticker tape rained down from the skyscrapers looming overhead. Maybe that's when the idea of circling the globe first popped into Earhart's head. They were calling her Queen of the Air. She had a meeting at the White House with President Calvin Coolidge, circled in her datebook. Already had bags of money being thrown at her feet for lecture tours, book deals, and endorsement contracts from Macy's and Lucky Strike. She hadn't even taken the controls during the transatlantic flight, just kept a meticulous plane's log. But watching the paper rain down from the sky, the cheering men, women, and children, she must have thought about the globe, even if the technology to pull it off wasn't quite there. 6 years later, 1933, a man with an eye patch named Wiley Post was the first man to circumnavigate the globe alone, flying from New York City to New York City in just over 7 days. He got his own trip down the Canyon of Heroes, his own accolades. 4 years later, Amelia Earhart made her dreams in Manhattan a reality. On June 1st, 1937, she took off from Oakland, California with her navigator Fred Newman, charting a flight plan that would take them around the world. They made it three quarters of the way around the world before the plane lost radio contact and disappeared. Official search efforts went on for a month and a half, but no physical evidence of the plane, Earhart, nor Noonan were ever found. Amelia's husband funded a private search as well, with similar results. Anne Holtgren was 2 months old when Earhart disappeared in the Pacific, born April 10, 1937, in Riverdale, Illinois, a suburb south of Chicago. Anne studied music at the University of Michigan and performed in the Michigan Symphony Band. That's where she met her husband Don Pellegrino. He played percussion and she French horn. The band took three buses when they'd tour, two for singles and one reserved for couples. They started on the singles buses, but by graduation were canoodling on the couples bus. She graduated from U of M in 1958 and became Anne Pellegrino. They moved to Saline, where Anne worked as a guidance counselor and English teacher in Saline area schools. Until now, there was nothing to suggest that Anne Pellegrino would one day fly around the world. Her interest in aviation was kind of a fluke. On a visit to Don's brothers, a naval aviator, Anne helped build and fly a gas-powered model airplane, and the Pellegrinos found that they had a marvelous time doing it. When they got back to Ann Arbor, her and Don signed up for flight lessons at Willow Run, bit hard by the flying bug. Anne took her first flight lesson in 1960 and earned her pilot's license in 1962, taking her mother up for a surprise flight as her first passenger. It made sense for them to invest in a plane of their own. So Anne and Don bought a used two-seat Cessna 140 and hired a local aviation mechanic named Lee Kopke to get it into flying shape. Kopke was an affable guy and a good mechanic who liked to fix up vintage planes in his spare time. His current project was rebuilding a Lockheed 10 Electra, the same airplane Amelia Earhart attempted to circle the globe in. The plane was literally a shell of itself, used by staff at Willow Run for firefighting practice. So Lee bought it, or maybe they just gave it to him. And he worked on it a few days a week, rebuilding it in an old Quonset hut at Willow Run. One day, Kopke casually proposed that when he was finished rebuilding the Electra, Anne should fly it around the world on the 30th anniversary of Earhart's attempt. The anniversary is 5 years away, and the farthest flight Anne had ever taken was Ann Arbor to Rockford, Illinois. It didn't seem like a serious proposition, so Anne said, sure, why not? Neither she nor Kopke thought much about it over the next few years. Anne continued flying, 100 flight hours, 1,000 flight hours. We kept working on that plane. Summer, winter, rain, shine. On Christmas Day, 1966, Anne unwrapped a present from her husband, a book about Amelia Earhart. It reminded her of the conversation her and Lee had 5 years earlier. Anne asked Lee if he'd finished restoring the old Lockheed. He had. Together they said, sure, why not, and agreed to fly around the world. Cue our getting the gang back together montage. The pilot, Anne. The engineer, Lee. They needed a navigator. Together they recruited Bill Paulimus, who owned the Ann Arbor navigation firm Paulimus Navigation Sciences. Bill supplied a lot of the expensive radio equipment for the flight, which was a nice bonus. Finally, they needed a co-pilot. Earhart didn't have one on her voyage, and Anne didn't want to make the same mistake. And boy did they pick a co-pilot. Air Force Colonel Bill Payne, who set a New York to Paris speed record in 1961 flying a B-58 jet. He'd do.
A 30-year-old airplane will help solve a 30-year-old mystery as it's flown by a 30-year-old schoolteacher. Mrs. Ann Pellegrino of Michigan, along with a co-pilot, navigator, and mechanic, will duplicate Amelia Earhart's flight of 1937.
The team had a lot of work to do to be ready for takeoff in June. Lee got to work on the plane. To make it lighter, he tore out 6 of the 10 seats in the Electra and stripped the interior down to its asbestos lining, ripping out the insulation and soundproofing material right down to the metal. Fuel tanks, custom made in Wichita, were crammed into the back of the plane. Giant radio racks installed inside. This work was expensive, especially for a school teacher and an airplane mechanic. And there weren't cigarette endorsements and ticker tape parades down the heart of New York City at the end of this runway. America was already in outer space, the world's attention beyond the globe itself. Champion Spark Plugs donated money and equipment, along with a few other sponsors that got their names stenciled on the side of the plane. But Anne would need a lot more to pay for her global flight. She packed 5,000 custom-made postcards commemorating the 30th anniversary flight, and after each stop, licked hundreds of stamps in foreign post offices, then sold them as souvenirs upon her return to the mainland. One night in Senegal, she had half the local police force licking stamps late into the night to help the crew stick to its schedule. She also gathered a box of items from everyone who donated to the cause, tucking the box in the back of the plane with the idea of returning these items once they landed. The owners proudly displaying the baseball or the fountain pen or the snow globe that traveled around the world with the first woman to do so. The endeavor put Anne $40,000 in debt, nearly $300,000 today. That included the plane, fuel, repairs, and a pricey insurance policy with Lloyd's of London. On June 7, 1967, Anne and her crew took off from Willow Run for Oakland, California, and Amelia Earhart's starting point 30 years earlier. The FAA examined the plane and said the engines were running like sewing machines, quiet and smooth. 2 days later, on a gray, overcast afternoon, the Lockheed 10 Electra, codenamed Rapid Rocket, took off from Oakland, beginning its round-the-world flight flying southeast. The woman the papers were calling the pretty Michigan housewife had never left the United States, and she was about to fly around the world. Not in a modern jet, but in a 30-year-old plane that, after it was done flying commercial passengers across Canada, had 14 private owners, one crash landing, and countless years of being set on fire for training purposes in its bones. I feel safer in a plane than a car, Pellegrino told one newspaper. The only thing a car is good for is getting to the airport so I can fly. They tried to follow Earhart's route as closely as possible, but deviations were necessary. They detoured to airfields offering free fuel and were forced to fly around the continent of Africa during the start of the Arab-Israeli Six-Day War. The crew wore earplugs under their headsets to keep from going deaf. The rattle of the plane was intense, free of anything that would prevent sound from bouncing around the flying metal tube. That also made it very cold. Didn't help that they tore out the heater to make more room for fuel tanks. They watched dozens of sunrises and sunsets high above the earth, eating cold sandwiches, sharing water from a thermos, and holding their pee, we think. A plywood bed was installed in the back where they took turns sleeping. Every takeoff was an adventure. Blind takeoffs at night with no lights to mark the horizon and relying solely on the instruments of that old bird. They landed at some of the same airfields Earhart had visited 30 years before, remote outposts in Portugal, Italy, and Thailand. Back in Saline, a world map had been added to the giant front windows of White's Cleaners, and each day, the owners updated it with Anne's progress. She wrote her husband almost every day, sending back news of her travels, receipts, or notes from the book she planned to write. Don stayed home, fielding daily phone calls from the media. He also got a few minutes on the phone with Anne every few days when they stopped in cities with good enough telephone lines. They charted a course for Howland Island, the location of Earhart's last transmission, but the airfield there was overgrown and unusable. They circled the Fingershape Island and its 4-mile coastline and taking photos at the left side of the plane. Anne and Lee headed for the rear of the plane as Colonel Payne steadied the approach. Lee kicked open the door, turbulence kicking up like crazy, and wrapped Anne in a bear hug while she leaned out and dropped a wreath out of the back of the plane. A beautiful wreath of colored leaves that the crew had picked up in New Guinea, intending to honor Earhart's final flight. It was July 2nd, nearly to the hour, 30 years later, that Anne's plane flew past that same unimpressive island in the Pacific where Earhart disappeared forever. They flew on, only a few more stops until their final destination. They landed in Oakland on July 7th, 1967, completing the trip around the world. 31 airports, 263 flight hours, 28,000 miles, safe and sound. Anne and the crew celebrated a few days later, then took off for home, landing at Willow Run on July 11th, happy but tired, met by 100 applauding admirers and the media. Anne got a ticker tape parade, though not down the Canyon of Heroes. Hers was through downtown Saline. Proud citizens and a circling helicopter rained pink ticker tape down on her convoy as they rolled through Saline on July 15th, Anne Pellegrino Day. She smiled and waved from the back of a convertible, just as Amelia Earhart had 40 years earlier. Anne wrote magazine articles, finished her book about the flight, and toured to raise money to pay for that journey. The Pellegrinos moved to Iowa in 1968, buying a 120-acre farm in Story City in 1970, and built an airstrip. Anne was appointed to the Iowa Department of Transportation in 1974 and continued her writing career, authoring 3 volumes on the history of aviation in Iowa. In 1997, they moved just outside Fort Worth, Texas, where Anne continued writing and Don rebuilt planes. The plane, what became of Lee Kopke's Lockheed 10 Electra? The Canadian Aviation Museum bought the plane from Lee following the famous flight and brought it back home, bringing it to its original configuration and displaying it in the Canadian Aviation and Space Museum in Ottawa. There it lives with hundreds of other vintage aircraft, but few with a more interesting story than the Rapid Rocket. Ann Arbor Stories is presented by Rumblepack Media in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. This episode was written and performed by me, Rich Reddy, with sound and audio engineering by Brian Peters. Thanks again to the AADL and their archive staff, who do an amazing job digitizing old newspaper clippings and photos from Ann Arbor's past. You should visit oldnews.aadl.org and explore something. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Ann Arbor Stories, or email us at annarborstories@gmail.com and let us know how we're doing. Thanks, as always.